Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The United States military will no longer distinguish between men and women when it comes to their role within the military. If you can do the job, you will, regardless of gender. So decreed United States Defense Secretary Ash Carter on December 3rd. And with this historic announcement come a lot of questions. Joining us now is Pentagon correspondent for Stars and Stripes, Tara Kopp. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
According to 2015 Pentagon statistics, 17% of the military's officers are women, and women make up about 15% of the enlisted military members. How might the policy change be reflected in recruiting?
I think that the Pentagon and Ash Carter, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, has regularly said that, you know, given the security environment, he doesn't want to limit his potential recruits to just one half the population. And being able to open up almost 200,000 additional combat-related roles for women, it just adds to what a potential new recruit could see in their future for the military.
Right, because that's 15% of 1.1 million, so 250, that's about, you know, roughly a fourth or so. That's a lot of slots.
Yeah, the 1.3 million strong military, about 204,000 total are women. And then service-wide, about 39,000 are officers. That makes up the 17% you were talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who's going to follow up to make sure this is happening properly?
Well, they have 7 points of implementation. Just for a little bit of a background on what to expect next. Over the next 30 days, each of the services is due to report back on how they're going to implement this policy. At the same time, you can expect to see the service chiefs and probably the Secretary of Defense, too, and staff making visits to the Hill, being congressional hearings to talk about not only implementation, but some of the data that was used to make the decision. I'm sure you're aware that there are various members on the Hill who are a little bit concerned about some of the reporting out of the U.S. Marine Corps that women were more prone to injury, that it might impact the culture of some of these elite combat units. And so you can expect for at least the next month to for the services to really be addressing these issues before they then step forward into the practical implementation that will go on through the early part of next year.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of women in the military. Ash Carter, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, announced last week that women would not be barred from any realm of the military based on gender. My guest right now, Tara Kopp. She's a Pentagon correspondent for Stars and Stripes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It may be too nuanced a question at this point, but I'm curious. Is there a sense that the how women are trained in the military might be different given different physiques and that sort of thing?
Actually, taking even a step back from that, if the studies, and I've had some time to go through a lot of the data that the Marine Corps and the Army and the Air Force presented to make their cases, it's not just the physique and act. In general, if you take your average female and your average male, there's going to be differences in physical capabilities, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But for the top scores within women and the top scores within men, things became a lot more similar in their performance, their rates of injury. And so you have to, as much as you can, look at apples to apples.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to determine performance in some of these more physical combat roles.
This decree was pretty much 3 years in the making. What was the origin? It started with Liam Panetta, right?
Actually, it started back in the 90s.
Okay.
In 1993, Secretary Les Aspin had decreed that some roles would be open. So some of the air combat roles, you started to see female pilots could occur, but ground roles and things that would require for equal housing in forward-based locations, those were still prohibited. You know, in the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of those barriers erode, whether the policy reflected it or not. All throughout Iraq and Afghanistan, you had equal facilities for females and males because they were both forward-based, and whether they were tail support or combat, you needed facilities to support them. You also saw combat in general What was combat? Was it at the tail where there happened to be a suicide bomber that still injured and killed people? Or was it just these forward-based outposts? So you saw a lot of the blurring of the lines, which I think has also fed to this decision.
Ash Carter's decision followed years of studies, as you mentioned, on the impact that integrating women into the all-male units would have on the military. And you mentioned in particular the Marines. What sort of studies did the Marines do that distinguished them from the other arms of the military?
Well, the Marines were the only service that requested an exemption for their roles. They asked for exemptions for about 48,000 positions. Their infantry positions, weapons officers, riflemen, machine gunners. They also asked for exemptions based on whether it was a small combat unit, such as a reconnaissance battalion or an assault company. And the justification they used was about a 33-month-long study that was conducted while now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dunford, was commandant of the Marine Corps. And it looked at whether women were getting injured more frequently, if it had impact on the morale of a unit. And some of the conclusions that they drew, particularly among the injury rates, that injury rates for women were higher, were ultimately challenged and questioned by some of the researchers who reviewed the work.
And these are the kind of questions that will be asked when this all goes before Congress.
Yes, these types of questions. And also as part of the implementation, there's 7 points to implementing this. And one of the points is that, you know, there is a question of physical capability, but should physical capability be tied to promotion, to being able to continue in a certain specialty? And what sort of universal physical requirements should be put in place to make sure that you're testing men and women to their capability and equally, and not creating any sort of exceptions or quotas?
Right. Equal opportunity won't necessarily be equal participation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Since 2013, as you mentioned, more than 110,000 formerly male-only positions have been open to female troops. What have we learned from those examples?
I think that opening some of those positions just reflected the reality that was already on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're going to see the real test is with these very specific combat roles, these infantry roles that are now open. Some of the others seem to be more on paper than, you know, what was already happening on the ground.
Okay, let's take a call. Sean and Galena, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I have three sisters. So, I mean, I am intimately aware of all, and I have three sisters who are working professional women who I'm intimately aware in their lives of the challenges they have had to overcome just to get on an equal platform with men. You know, barriers do exist, and we need to work those down. But I had a comment, and really this, my big concern is this. And I was watching CNN, and this gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps, a woman, gave this really good example. She said, well, you know, if you are a Navy SEAL diver and you spend, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of hours diving, in really, really strenuous combat areas, just biologically speaking, women do have less lung capacity than men. And so we don't know what the long-term effects of women diving in a, you know, combat area, if you have to plant a mine on the sub or you have to, you know, defend a port, and we don't know what the long-term effects of these of having less lung capacity is. One example. The second example she gave is to say, well, let's say that you're a Green Beret in the middle of the Philippines, and you have to, part of your training is you check your partner in, you know, very, very intimate areas for things such as, you know, insect bites and different rashes and stuff like that. You know, how is that going to affect mm-hmm. the camaraderie of a really small, highly trained group of men and possibly women if they are checking each other's, you know, private areas for mm-hmm. for things that, you know, could be health concerns? That's a legitimate concern because that's part of the training. Mm-hmm. They're trained to check their buddy because they can't obviously check everywhere. So, you know, I'm completely on board with the majority of what you guys are talking about, but I think that we are maybe a little bit making a compromise in the long run for a short-term,
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
I'm sorry, that's okay, Sean.
yeah, you made your point, and you made it very well, and I thank you for your call. Let's hear from Tara Kopp. These topics must have come up in the process of all this, right, Tara?
Sure. And to address the first part, thanks for calling in. I would say we're not taking the average male or average female. When we had Captain Kristen Greist and First Lieutenant Shane Hare and Major Lisa Jaster earn the Ranger tab, they weren't average female physiques. They were the exception. And when you're talking about things like lung capacity, sure, as a general rule, men may be able to hold more oxygen or may, you know, whatever that specific average is. But these are the exceptions. And, you know, Major Jaster is a 37-year-old mother of two, and yet she still had the physique and the mental capability and the endurance to earn the Ranger tab. So the people that are going to be in these positions, you know, your Navy SEAL is not your average man or woman on the street. It's really the rare exception.
And what about the intimacy issues that he brought up, you know, checking for bugs, that kind of a thing?
Well, I don't know about that specific, situation. Mm-hmm. But one of the things the services will have to address is the overall culture of having women in combat. And that's something that's going to have to be addressed within the services and in very specific small unit levels. Just as an offshoot of that, there's another aspect of culture that's not, you know, just about private parts. A lot of the places that these special units are assigned and go work and they train or they do missions, mm-hmm, are places in the world that are not accepting of women in this role. And that is actually going to be an aspect that's considered as to whether a woman would be put in a combat unit that deploys to a certain region. So the culture on both sides.
Right. And yet women have also been found to be very helpful in some parts of the world where women are not necessarily accepted in the role, but they've been able to help because they're women.
Exactly. There are women-only units that go in and deal with women's issues in some of these Middle Eastern countries where females there don't have a lot of health options or don't have a lot of personal rights. And we've had a very effective role that way.
And as far as the issue of the draft, Thursday's decision or last week's decision to allow women in all combat roles could lead to a draft requirement as well, depending on the outcome of a federal lawsuit challenging male-only registration. Does it tilt the scales in favor of draft requirements for women?
It does. And that those oral arguments will be heard about an hour from now in a court in California. It was a case that was brought by an organization called the National Coalition for Men. They raised the case in 2013 after then Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta opened the 111,000 positions, not all of them, but 111,000 of them. And then at that point, a lower court found that because not all combat positions were open, the case was premature. So the group appealed, and their appeal just happens to be today, 4 days after this historic decision. The attorney representing that group is expecting that either the appellate court, will decide that the lower court's decision was appropriate at the time, in which case they will refile now that the landscape has changed. Mm-hmm. And you can expect to see that kind of case go forward. Or the court may decide that because all of the facts have changed, they'll remand. And, you know, this decision may come faster than we anticipate.
And there's been other lawsuits filed by women on behalf of women to get them equal access. What happens to those lawsuits?
I'm not an attorney, but I think that just with precedence, you just need one to punch through. But mm-hmm. In addition, the White House is having the Department of Justice review the draft policy, given now that all combat roles are open to women. Mm-hmm. And in general, the women's groups that I've talked to, one of them, the Service Women's Action Network, their CEO, Jean yeah. Patterson, said the draft is just another gender-based policy rooted in another era, and that they are ready and willing and able to register for the draft.
Okay. Well, Tara Kopp, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tara Kopp, she's a Pentagon correspondent for Stars and Stripes. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The Pentagon announced on December 3rd that it would open up all its positions, including combat, to women. We're talking about the potential and consequences of this historic reversal in eligibility for women in the military. Coming up, we'll hear from a critic of the change. Joining us now by phone is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Gail Zimak Laman. Her most recent book is Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Nice to join you.
Also joining us by phone is veteran Marine Corps officer and research fellow in international studies at the University of Denver, Kyle Ann Hunter. She flew the AH-1W Super Cobra attack helicopter and combat missions in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. She also served as the Marine Corps liaison officer to the House of Representatives from 2009 to 2012. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In August, two women made history by graduating from the U.S. Army's Elite Ranger School. They were the first to achieve that distinction. How significant was that feat? Because a lot of our conversation keeps going back to the physicality, you know, the raw material of women versus men. Kyle Ann Hunter?
Thank you. Well, it clearly was a very, very significant day. It was a day that saw women from all services really link arms in support of their sisters in arms. And why Ranger School in particular, I think, was very significant is that it is a school that's not only very tough physically, but also very tough mentally. It requires a lot of leadership and tactical proficiency, as well as just brute physical strength. And so what this historic day did was, I think, squash a lot of these objectively measurable arguments, you know, that women can never be strong enough, that women will never have the tactical skills, that women will never have the leadership abilities under stress. You know, that there's something uniquely different about men and women that's going to separate women apart based on these raw measurable things. And, you know, a school like Ranger School was a perfect test for it because there were set standards that had been in place for a very, very long time. The curriculum was known, and it was known to be hard and the elite school, not just physically, but mentally and tactically as well.
Gail, how significant is it from where you sit, your most recent book, Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield, probably gets into a lot of those issues?
It does, but it happens to be a story about what women had already done years before the combat ban was lifted. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a story about a team of women recruited for special operations combat missions way back in 2010, 2011, before anybody really knew that they existed. And they were recruited for Army Ranger and Navy SEAL missions because there was a whole chunk of the population that was out of reach to special operations forces, and that was women. Because in a conservative and traditional society such as Afghanistan, if you were going to get access to the entire population, and which battlefield in which knowledge was key, you really did need to have women there. But I think the key to that story also was that it was really a story of friendship, a story of teamwork, a story of valor, and a story of women who may have been recruited because they were female, but they proved themselves because they were excellent soldiers. And I think they stood on the shoulders of everybody who came before them, and then they helped to pave the way for the incredible women who have completed Ranger School and all those who will come afterward.
So there was that sisterhood there, but what about the relationship between men and women in those same circumstances, Gail? I mean, do you have a sense about that?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think a lot of people are surprised by the fact that, you know, we always talk about behind every great man is an even greater woman. And I think in this case, alongside and supporting these soldiers on the battlefield were men who trained them, men who served alongside them, who may have been skeptical when they started. But the truth was that 10 years into America's longest war, all anyone cared about was the mission.
Mm-hmm.
I think so often we underestimate our soldiers and think that that would be secondary. But the truth is, you fought that much war, all you care about is, Do you bring value to the mission? Do you help me figure out what we need to get done, accomplish the objective, and get back home safely? And these young women who were recruited in 2011 certainly did that. And Ashley's War is that story about so many Rangers who, however they felt about women on the battlefield, in theory, were glad to have people who brought value to the mission, who made a difference every single night, night in, night out, alongside them. And I think that set the tone for some of the Rangers you talked to who were part of the Ranger School experience. And the women graduating from Ranger School kind of said, you know, they really did change the conversation. I noted from a policy standpoint, it went from, you know, if women can graduate from Ranger School to, okay, now that women have graduated from Ranger School, what do we do overnight? I mean, it's really remarkable that two young soldiers carried that much responsibility on their shoulders.
But someone has to do it, right?
Absolutely, and I think they did.
Kylan Hunter, you're a veteran Marine Corps officer. The pushback, the lone pushback in all of this came from the Marine Corps. What do you make of that?
So I think there's really kind of three major issues as to why the Marine Corps push back so much. One is just this cultural aspect, which for whatever reason, and it's again one of these intangibles, there's this hyper masculinity. Elliot Ackerman, who's a fellow Marine Corps veteran as well, and it's wonderful having this come from a male, has published several op-eds in the New York Times, you know, about the sort of prevalence of this hyper masculine culture that exists in the Marine Corps. And I can postulate quite a bit as to what it is, you know, that it's the smallest service, it's, you know, the few, the proud, the few good men, you know, this, you know, this sort of ethos that the warrior culture has been predominantly male. The encouraging side of this is that you see this in the senior leadership, but not as much in the junior leadership. Really, the past close to 15 years now of our current conflict has really changed that culture from the bottom up. The Marine Corps, whether it was the Lioness program or some of the female engagement teams, which are very similar to the type of units that Gail was talking about, their success, the integration of women into combat aviation, like my unit, myself, I was the first female Cobra pilot in my squadron. So just showing the mission critical, not only the mission critical aspect that women bring in, but also the mission success and the way they complement it has started to change that from the bottom up. So unfortunately, it still exists a lot in the top, but the new Marine Corps is changing. So that is number one. Number two, I think, is that prior to this announcement back in 2013, there were no objective standards for any of these closed units. For example, to go to either infantry officer school, which is the officer equivalent, or the school of infantry for the enlisted, the only requirement was that you were male. And it actually came out in one of the findings of the studies that the Marine Corps admitted they'd had an assumption that being male meant you were qualified to do the job. And that was it. And so this lack of objective standards, really, there was no way to even figure out how women would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Ranger School, you know, that had these very set, both physical and tactical and academic requirements to start, there was nothing like that for the infantry. So they were starting from a blank slate, and it was very it presented problems. Like with no sort of natural mechanism to screen women to come in, they were an unknown quantity. There was nothing to smooth that transition. And finally, it really comes down to the unequal training that men and women have from the beginning. The Marine Corps still, for the enlisted in particular, has segregated training, where it's men trained separate from women in boot camp. And this results in lower standards and lower expectations for women. And
why do they do that?
It goes back again to just a cultural tradition. When women started becoming Marines back in the World War II era, the difference of their job was what set them apart. You know, women were in, you know, the support and auxiliary units, and they were specifically trained for that. So I think that tradition has just perpetuated and has become so ingrained in the culture. And it's one of the things that, you know, where culture and action just reinforce each other. And when things become so institutionally entrenched, they're hard to change.
Mm-hmm.
But what that's done is really set women up for failure. to integrate into these units. When you have lower physical expectations, when you have lower tactical expectations, and when you receive less hours of instruction, you're not going to do as well. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these initial tests with women who all of a sudden, where they've been held to lower standards, be told to perform at a lower level, and essentially overnight are now expected to perform at a higher level, it's just not going to work. And what's even more telling, I think, is that when leaders push back against this, you know, in the case of Colonel Kate Germano at Paris Island, when leaders start to push back, they get reprimanded. So thankfully, the conversation is starting, and what is hopefully going to happen is you're going to start seeing higher expectations from the get-go, because women have proven across the board that when held to higher standards, they meet them. And when given the tools to perform physically and tactically, they are able to. But it's about setting those equal standards and giving the equal playing field from day one.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Of course, we're talking about women in the military. It's been entirely opened up to access to women, at least equally access. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Hey, you know, I think some interesting points were brought up that, you know, women actually do have some capabilities that men don't have. And I think that that's universal. I think that, you know, women and men both have, you know, very strengths and weaknesses. And I think that, you know, there are variables in that. I'm not saying every man or every woman's the same, but I think generally on a physiological level, you're seeing, you know, patterns in the way men and women act, react. And I think that another thing we need to analyze is that through a lot of the studies we've seen from the Marine Corps and the military, we're seeing time and time again that all-male infantry battalions are more combat effective through these studies.
Well, what about what Kyle Ann Hunter just brought up, David? Because you're a former combat Marine, right?
Yeah.
What about what she just brought up about the fact that women are trained separately, they're trained differently, and what if we trained everybody the same and maybe even together? Think about that. What do you think that might generate a different specimen?
I think it would generate a different specimen, absolutely. And I think what you're definitely going to be seeing is a lot of people skeptical about it, specifically the infantry as of now. There's a lot of skepticism now of if that is okay, because I think when you look at the big picture here, you know, the Marine Corps is an organization designed to fight and win our nation's battles and wars. And I think we need to look at, is this, you know, is that the purpose of, you know, this organization, or are we kind of testing it as a social experiment to see if it's, you know, are we testing the waters there? So I think the studies were good that they did, and I think that we need to, you know, even if you're against that idea, maybe if you think, even if you think that women should be in the infantry, women should be, you know, anywhere, I think you should at least analyze the studies, maybe even continue them a little bit and to see what we find. I think, like I said, I think the other side brings up a lot of great points, and don't get me wrong, I'm a big advocate of women's rights. I feel like we got to look at the big picture and see that, you know, what is this organization designed for and what are the studies telling us? And like I said, they're going to be variables.
Right.
And I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I am saying from personal experience and from talking to many people with a lot of that are experts and have experience that this is a very common view. And I think it should be taken seriously considering it involves lives.
Okay.
Lives,
so. All right. Well,
May I respond to that comment about the study, though?
Yeah. Is this Kyle Ann?
This is Kyle Ann.
Yeah, sure. Kyle Ann Hunter.
The common perception that the study showed that all male infantry units were more effective is just wrong. I've finally been able to see the full study, like the full 200-page objective data in study. And what comments like that are going off of is a one-page summary that was released to the press from one analyst that looked at the data. And what you see is that in certain tasks, all male infantry units perform better. And those tasks tended to be things like lifting heavy loads or running faster. And again, when you actually separate out the equal training level, so if you look at women who were trained at the same level as men prior to starting this experiment, they had almost the exact same performance in these tasks. So it comes to an issue of training. And number two, what was found was that the mixed gender units actually performed better in complex cognitive tasks and in long-term effectiveness. So when they talk about, you know, securing a simulated village for weeks or months.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about what the purpose of the military actually is, it's to win wars, as the caller rightly said.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to acknowledge the changing definition of that. We haven't had a infantry on infantry, you know, hand-to-hand battle since World War II. The nature of counterinsurgency, the nature of the future enemy, and the nature of technology that we currently have to fight wars, it's more about brute strength. These skills are teachable, and these skills are essential that they are held to a high standard
mm-hmm.
with the infantry, but we're not rushing the beaches and taking over a country anymore. We need to understand that counterinsurgency requires the hearts and minds side, which women have been very, very effective in doing, and also really look at what's the political role of the military, because winning wars isn't about just, you know, taking over cities. In fact, that is very counter to a lot of our political purposes of winning wars right now.
Guilliman, what about the culture? How, what's your sense about how well the culture is going to be able to adapt to this? Maybe not over time, but maybe in the someone's career, a 5 to 10 year career in the military,
right?
Which is kind of realistic for most people. What can we expect?
I mean, I think so much of this conversation, and we found this all the time in Ashley's war, and Ashley actually was a Kent State graduate, so and an Ohio native for your listeners, was that it becomes this abstraction, what women could do, what women should do, and mm-hmm. almost no time has been given to talking about what Marines like Kyle Ann, what soldiers like those in Ashley's team mm-hmm. were able to accomplish. We've spent so much time on the abstract idea of women in combat and almost none looking at what they already have done in America's name, fighting 14 years of war with, you know, less than 0.5% of this country fighting 100% of its wars. And I think the culture has changed, mm-hmm. particularly, as Kyle Ann said, among those who have served alongside women throughout their careers. You really see that for them it is far less shocking to think of women who would be right alongside them in infantry, because women have already been receiving Silver Stars, Purple Hearts, combat action badges in the thousands, right? This is not terribly shocking in terms of a huge, great step forward. What it is a natural progression of what's already been going on in the battlefield while America was paying, you know, precious little attention. And I think the military culture has changed far more than civilians, than all of us outside the military have given it credit for. If you want to look at Ranger School, I covered Ranger School this summer, and it's opening to all women, mm-hmm. to female soldiers. And what you saw was that the leadership of Army Ranger School had long served with women and had commanded women soldiers. So it was not a terribly huge leap for them to see women alongside men. And it always come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the right person for the right job mm-hmm. protecting and defending America's national security? This has never been about proving a point for any of the women in uniform involved. It has been about serving with purpose, and it's been about patriotism. And I've, you know, strained to see something controversial in that.
Kyle Ann Hunter, could you talk a little bit about what this means for women in the military and their options in terms of making the military more of a career instead of, you know, getting to a certain point and then seeing a glass ceiling and walking away?
Yes. Well, it's shown that if you look at the senior leadership, especially in the Marine Corps general officer rank, it's infantry is one of the predominant requirements.
Right.
You know, that and now that's an option. I mean, that's something that is no longer and I think if anything, it's going to really open the door to egalitarianism, because they won't be able to close the door and say, oh, well, you weren't infantry, so we're not promoting you any higher. And, you know, given those options, it's going to allow women to really succeed. And the other thing it's going to do is allow each individual to you know, really play on their greatest strength. There are not every woman will be a proper infantry Marine. You know, like Gail has brought up, it's about what these individuals can offer. And what this does is offer women with that skill set the opportunity. And where that is where they're going to make the most good and actually make it a career. One of the biggest detriments to things like the female engagement program that we had is that women went through all of the infantry training, yet were not given the credit for it.
Yeah.
They didn't get the additional military occupational specialty designator as either an infantry officer or an infantry Marine. They had no ability to actually lead infantry Marines in combat. Opening up those career options is going to draw actually your best talent to jobs like this.
Well, you know, that's what I wondered about recruitment. Fair. Yeah,
absolutely.
And with that as well, it goes again to, I think, a lot of the fallacy of some of these studies that have been conducted. For example, getting women to go to infantry officer course. You know, that women who infantry officer course is about 3 months long, a little longer depending on when you actually report. And when they opened the call to women to be able to go, it's basically this first experiment. Not only were these women not as physically prepared as men, but there was really no incentive. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were told they were going to go, and then they'd have to go to their regular follow-on school for whatever their job is. So really all this did was set them 3 to 6 months behind their peer group in job proficiency. And if you think about the people who are the most motivated Marines, the ones who want to get out there and make a difference, regardless of their gender, they want to do their job. You know, they don't want to be part of an experiment. And so, you know, again, to this caller's point, is it a social experiment? I would say absolutely not. I say it's the opportunity for the best, the most qualified, the most motivated that our country has to offer to actually use those talents and not be part of an experiment now. You know, if we talk about it and say, oh, well, let's see if women can do this, let's see if women can do that. Gail has so rightfully shown in all of her incredible work getting the stories out that women have been doing this. It's now about giving them the recognition and the opportunity to actually make a career out of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And then thereby, Gail, attracting more people that might have foregone a career in the military because it was would be truncated somewhat.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, you talk to Army leadership, and in fact, their concern is that they're going to lose. I was at West Point recently, and they were bemoaning the fact that other service academies are getting more women than they are because, you know, if people see more opportunities in the Air Force or the Navy,
mm-hmm.
Then everybody's going to be fighting for, you know, the most talented young women who otherwise might have gone into athletics or otherwise might have gone into competitive sports,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think you see that race for talent going on. And it really is true. You know, at the end of Ashley's War, there was this really moving scene that, in fact, some special operations leaders have talked to me about, which is, you know, the special operations general comes, one of the leaders of special operations community comes and says, thank you. You've done a tremendous job on the battlefield. We really appreciate it. And they say, okay, so how do we keep doing this mission, right? All we want to do is go out with the best of the best
mm-hmm.
at the center of the fight and do a mission that matters, right? Test ourselves and service to our country. And they said, well, you know, we don't have any place for you to go. You know, everything you want to do is off limits to women. This was a one-year deployment, and, you know, we don't have anything more for you. And, you know, where do you go if you've already done that kind of service alongside Army Rangers and Navy SEALs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many of them left, and that is a loss to this country, right? If you want to talk about having the best people signing up to protect and defend America and her Constitution, you want the most talented, most fit, most mentally ready people who have already been battle tested. And when you say, okay, there's really no place else for you to go, and this wasn't because the commanders didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
it was because the rules and regulations didn't allow it. Yeah.
Well, Gail Zemach-Lamon, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you.
Great to join you.
Okay, we'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Pentagon announced on December 3rd that it would open up all its positions, including combat, to women. talking about the potential and consequences of this historic reversal in eligibility for women in the military. To help Pentagon leaders decide on the issue, each branch of the armed forces assessed the impact of opening combat positions to women. Only the Marines recommended keeping certain combat positions closed to women. Still with us is veteran Marine Corps officer and research fellow in international studies at the University of Denver, Kyle Ann Hunter. And joining us now by phone is writer and Marine Corps veteran Jude Eden. Welcome to the show, Jude.
Thanks.
You've written that adding women to combat forces creates more danger for everyone. How so?
Well, regardless of whether a few hard-charging and star athletic females are able to pass some of the standards, women still carry with them many additional risks that men simply don't have in combat. Military women, even before they start, we start talking about infantry standards, are already get injured more than twice as much as men, and that statistic remains the same regardless of fitness or how athletic the women are. So on that alone, that means that women are going to have to be replaced in these units at far higher rates. They're in much greater danger, that it reduces their survivability and their lethality in combat, and it also puts at risk the men around them. Women are also at a disadvantage, no matter how strong they are, against men who want to kill them in hand-to-hand combat, and technology has not actually changed the reality of the violence and the closeness. The point-blank range of direct ground combat. If you get to know Iraq or Afghanistan combat veterans, infantrymen, or if you read their accounts, they're still talking about having to kill the enemy with their bare hands or with rocks or whatever they can get their hands on if the rifle jams or runs out of ammunition. So this is still... we're still dealing with hand-to-hand fighting, and the injuries and this kind of thing, and in addition, the increased risk of capture, because women for this enemy, which is so savage and vicious to its own women, they're particularly vicious to the enemy, and women are at higher risk of capture. They target women because we have a higher propaganda value. There's nothing we can do to mitigate that. So we're adding risk, we're not adding strength, and we're speed and strength are weapons that can't be mitigated for. This doesn't do us any favors. It doesn't do women any favors.
Let me ask you a couple follow-up questions on that. Two things you said that caught my ear. No matter how strong they are, you said. Well, how could that be? No matter how strong they are, they can't do hand-to-hand combat if it requires that.
I'm not saying they can't do hand-to-hand combat. I'm saying that they're at a significant disadvantage when it comes to fighting men. I mean, even Ronda Rousey, at the height of her winnings as a world champion UFC fighter, said, when people said, "You're so tough, would you fight a man?" And she said, "No, that would be an unfair fight, even if they were classed the same." So in hand, you also realize that even since we went to Iraq in 2003, we're dealing with enemies who are on methamphetamines, adrenaline. I mean, they're amping themselves up, making them even harder to kill for our men. That's all the more an unfair advantage against women.
Kyle Ann Hunter, this somewhat contradicts what you said earlier about the nature of warfare in modern times?
Well, yes. But first to the point on women being at a disadvantage, and it'll segue very well into the nature of warfare. It's this game of averages that's always quoted in these sort of things. Like, well, the average woman is at a disadvantage. And that may be true, but the Marine Corps also isn't in the business of recruiting the average or training the average. And it's not saying that all women are going to be in the infantry. Mm-hmm. It's giving the opportunity for women to do this who are properly trained and meet the standards. So that's point one. There is that these arguments about physical strength are always based off averages, and yet this isn't about the average. And two, to the point of the changing warfare, yes, close quarters combat exists, which is why training is still very, very, very important with all of this. Mm-hmm. But when we look at the overall purpose of the military and the overall purpose of the infantry, those things have changed. And we need to train to the way we're actually fighting. Having been in Iraq and Afghanistan, it is, yes, there are times when it comes down to close quarters and to point blank range. However, those things can be trained. And to the point about how it's a enemy that is savage towards women, it's just as savage towards our men. If you look at the prisoners of war, whether they are actually, for those who are captured as opposed to prisoners of war, whether they are military or Western journalists, Western aid workers, mm-hmm. you know, our enemy has been just as brutally sexually, just as brutally physically to the men as it has to the women. And in this case, having been a woman in Afghanistan in some NGO context as well, mm-hmm. you know, this enemy views Western women as essentially a third sex. It doesn't view them the same way it views their women, just culturally. It's a different, it's an other, it's an enemy.
Judy, I want to get to another point because we're running out of time. You wrote that women can serve their country in all sorts of noble capacities and enjoy long and lofty military careers. I read that in a column you wrote. But 3 years ago, you know, two female U.S. Army reservists filed a lawsuit to overturn restrictions on women in combat, saying that they limit their current and future earnings, their potential for promotion and advancement, and their future retirement benefits. And Greg Jacob of the Service Women's Action Network has said that if the restrictions remained, we wouldn't see a woman as commandant of the Marine Corps or CENTCOM commander or chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Do you think those kinds of advancements can occur without opening up the military to women on every level?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we want, we could certainly look at how women are promoted and the ranking structure. But I'd like to address the issue of averages. Mm-hmm. When we talk about women's strength and injuries and stuff like that, we're not talking about average women. We're talking about military women, even before they get to the infantry standards, which are much more physically demanding. And in the Marines 9-month integration study, the 100 women volunteers who volunteered for that, they were top performers. They had made the men's minimum PFT standards and through the enlisted infantry training. And yet and still, the statistics on injuries were still consistently more than twice the injuries of the men. And they underperformed the men on 69% of tasks, the combat tasks. So, and even where they were able to perform some of the same tasks, they weren't able to perform them with the same speed and power as men. And speed and power, endurance, those are the critical elements that can't be mitigated for in combat. And we can utilize our rock star females in the combat zone for things where we need them in particular, mm-hmm. like gathering intelligence. We can do that without full repeal, which now subjects, you know, all women to selective service obligations, and it also turns, you know, choice into no choice, because now all active duty women who are high performers, you know, qualified women, can be involuntarily assigned. And the Army polled its enlisted women in 2014 and found that 92.5% of them don't want to be assigned. Hmm. And so, you know, where you're under orders and they're under obligations to implement this policy, they're going to have to pull from what they've got.
Judy Eden, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
That's Judy Eden. She's a writer, a Marine Corps veteran. Also, Kyle Ann Hunter, veteran Marine Corps officer and research fellow in international studies at the University of Denver. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
After Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon, 89.7 NPR News takes a break from the news.
I'm sure you do something somewhat earthy crunchy. I brew craft beer for
I
you.
Knew it!
Feisty for a lawbreaker, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, hey, Gail, cool it all. We gotta give me a name.
That's one thing you can say about Ohio.
Oh!
Man, so many Ohioans there.
Wait, wait, don't tell me. Car Talk and Ask Me Another, adding a little levity and laughter to your weekend. Listen Saturday morning starting at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from NS2, presenting Tommy Emmanuel performing a set of Christmas tunes and his own classics at the Capitol Theater tonight. Tickets available now at kappa.com. And another hour of All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday, in just a moment. It's 11 o'clock. Thanks for joining us.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.
Identity theft has become an everyday fact of life. In 2014 alone, more than 12 million U.S. consumers were victims of identity fraud. Phishing scams, hacking, mass data breaches. They're just a few of the methods thieves use to steal your precious data. Coming up on Tech Tuesday, more on those tactics and how to protect yourself from the threat of identity theft. Plus, Russell Holley continues his gift guide, turning to the adults on your holiday shopping list. That's Tech Tuesday after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.